This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. At the same time we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And you can always find the show after we broadcast at the same place. And today we're going to begin our show with Melissa Sobolek. She is the president of the Great Plains Food Bank. And we're going to check in and see how her business has fared in the current pandemic. Thanks for joining us, Melissa.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Let's get a little background first. Who do you serve? How large is your service area?
So the Great Plains Food Bank is the one and only food bank in the state of North Dakota, and we serve the entire state and Clay County, Minnesota. And last year was a record-breaking year for us. We served over 102,000 people. So that's one in eight of our citizens who needed a food box or a hot meal last year.
And do you anticipate that this worldwide emergency of sorts will increase the need for you?
Absolutely. And we are doing everything we can, and it is all hands on deck right now, making sure that we have adequate food supply to reach out to all of the corners of North Dakota where people have maybe been laid off or their hours have been cut. School kids are now at home and families need to feed them three meals a day because they don't have that school lunch. We're preparing for a huge increase in need.
How many people do you employ?
We have 36. So we have 31 of them here in Fargo, and we have four people out in Bismarck.
And how are your employees adapting to the social distancing and all of those other requirements that people are taking in order to protect themselves?
You know, it certainly is a challenge. You know, not only do we have office staff here, but out in the warehouse, we have, thousands of volunteers who come through our door. And we have really beefed up our cleaning and sanitation and hand washing to make sure that our staff stay safe, our volunteers stay safe. And of course, we have safe food going out to people who need it. I know we have gotten a question about, are you still taking volunteers during this crisis? And we certainly are. We actually have a heightened need because we know that the needs will be increasing. And so we need to pack up more food than ever before. And we are making sure that our volunteers who are coming in, we're doing groups of less than 10 people. We are making sure that they can stay 6 feet away from one another and have very rigorous a screening process and hand washing and sanitation that all of our volunteers are going through as soon as they enter our door.
And what do volunteers do?
We are doing a lot of pre-packed boxes right now. A lot of the food pantries across the state have been client choice, where a client can come in and shop like they do at a grocery store. But a lot of that is being eliminated right now just because we don't want to have that direct personal contact. And so we're pre-packing boxes anywhere from 20 to 25 pounds of shelf-stable product, packing it up, and then getting that out to our food pantries.
Now, in the event of a lockdown order, and this has been the case in some states already, would your workers be classified as essential workers? I know in some grocery stores that's the case.
Yeah, and really we have been researching that, and it varies by state, but we have reached out to Governor Burgum to make sure that we would be classified as essential services and on the Minnesota side as well. So we're hoping that that will cover not only the food bank, but all of the food pantries across the state and our volunteers, because we need them to be able to come and do the work to get the food out.
Does a nonprofit like the Great Plains Food Bank risk any liability issues with volunteers during a pandemic?
That's actually something we looked at, and that's why we're doing such a rigorous screening. So as soon as a volunteer comes in our door, we're asking them, are you feeling well? Do you have a cough? Do you have any of the symptoms? Have you traveled both internationally or domestically in the last 14 days? And then we explain what they're going to have to do in our warehouse, which is hand washing, gloves, any time that they take their gloves off or if our volunteer coordinators see that they maybe scratch their face, we're pulling them aside. They have to re-hand wash, re-glove up. And so that's how we're working around the liability, because we do need the volunteers just to keep our operation running.
Have there been changes to your mobile pantries?
That's a great question. What we have seen actually nationwide with food banks all across the country, they have been now taking up the model that we have deployed for a number of years, which is a drive-through model. So when we do our mobile food pantry, clients don't have to get out of their vehicle. They just drive up. It's like a drive-through. They fill out their paperwork and we load the food directly into their car. And the only adaption we've had to make right now is that they are not filling out and we're not handing them paperwork because we don't want to have that contact. And so we're trying to stay 6 feet apart from them and just collect verbally all their information that we need.
Now, you provide food to shelters and soup kitchens, don't you?
We do. And that's definitely a challenge right now. I just got a phone call yesterday. Our soup kitchens are considered congregate meal sites, and so they can't be open right now. And they can only do like to-go boxes and hand those out. But as I'm sure you have seen, grocery stores don't have bread. And so our soup kitchens are really scrambling, trying to put to-go bags together to hand out to people without any bread. And so we're doing everything we can to get our hands on some bread for them.
And shelters, or do you just provide the food and then the shelter has to deal with the distribution?
Yes, that is exactly it. And so they are getting creative, about how to serve different people. I know some are doing grab-and-go bags. Some are doing frozen meals and sending. It really depends on what means the client has to prepare and eat that food.
You mentioned bread being a little bit scarce. Are there certain foodstuffs mm-hmm. that you're struggling to find?
You know, right now, bread is a big one. We also need a lot of shelf-stable product. What we have seen over the years at the food bank is more and more produce has been getting donated to us. And we're seeing that sort of level off right now. And then the shelf-stable product that we used to get from retailers and grocery stores and supermarkets has declined a little bit. There are so many people who are going out, stocking up, so they have those food items at home, and there's been less and less of that product donated to us. And we are faced with the fact that we may have to purchase some food that we would otherwise get donated. And that's something we're raising funds to do, and we want to make sure that we have adequate food supplies to feed everyone in need.
Remind us again, who are your principal donators of food?
They primarily the food industry. So we get a lot of our food donated directly from manufacturers like General Mills or Nabisco. We get a lot from retailers, across the state, whether it's Walmart, Sam's Club, Target, various grocery stores. And then we get a lot of really great farmers who are growing extra produce for us and donating that as well. And food drives, that's a great way to get some of a good variety of product into the warehouse pretty quickly. And so that's where we're getting a lot of our food. And, we are looking right now to say, if those supplies start to dip, which we're just starting to see this week, what are we going to need to do? And we know that the next step is to purchase product.
And how is your funding?
We have just been having conversations about that. We figure that we are going to need at least another $500,000 to get the food out that we need to in response to the COVID crisis. And we are fundraising for that. We certainly don't want to turn people away. We know that there's an increased need and people are needing our services, and we want to be there to provide for them and their families. And so we are going to be raising funds to not only increase our distributions out across the state, but purchase the food. We know that it's going to take some additional manpower, and we are committed to doing that. And so we're hoping that the community, if they can, will help support us during this very tough time in our community, our state, and our world, and really respond to our neighbors in need.
Other than a fund drive, does the state of North Dakota, the state of Minnesota, provide some essential funding as well?
On the Minnesota side, there are five different food banks who are getting together and asking the legislature for some funding. I think the challenge we have on the North Dakota side is we don't have a legislative session right now. And so we may look to a special session or may look to the governor and reach out and see what funding is available. At this point, we know that, you know, that's not, maybe won't happen. So we are going to be very active and proactive to see what we can raise as well.
Since schools are shut down statewide, lots of kids are home now. And I know that there have been efforts by schools to provide the usual breakfast and lunches that they typically offer to students who meet the criteria. But I assume that your business is peaking a bit because of that as well.
It certainly is. And we have been providing backpacks for kids for about 10 years. Those kids who came chronically hungry to school on Monday mornings because there wasn't adequate food over the weekend, now those kids are home 7 days a week. And we've been working very closely with school districts to get them the backpacks that they have historically been getting to make sure that they get out to the kids who need them the most. But we also know that not every school has the capacity to do those grab-and-go meals, especially in the rural areas. And those families are turning to food pantries for the first time. They maybe have never had a need before, but now they want to make sure that they're caring for their child. And we're seeing that they need more food or that they're coming to us for the first time.
And if somebody does need this kind of assistance, what's the quickest, easiest way to notify you about that?
Well, the best thing they can do is go to our website, and that's greatplainsfoodbank.org. We have a list of all of the food pantries and soup kitchens across the state. We are keeping that updated. As soon as we hear about any changes in hours or adjustments that those agencies are making, we're putting that up on the site, and it will have all the contact info for those agencies as well.
You mentioned the 36 employees that you have, and, of course, there are other people everywhere where there are pantries and soup kitchens and that kind of thing. In the event that someone comes to work who's positive, ultimately, and that means everybody else has to, you know, quarantine themselves. That could severely impact your distribution process, couldn't it?
Absolutely. You know, it certainly could. And we are taking contingencies. We have eliminated all staff travel, work travel outside of the Fargo, outside of North Dakota and Clay County. If anyone, and we haven't seen anyone who has been interested in traveling from our staff, but if they do, we are asking them, if you come back from an international trip or a domestic trip, to self-quarantine for 14 days. In the event that one of our staff or our volunteers become infected, we will certainly remove that individual from that situation and follow, you know, the Department of Health guidelines about contacting other people and staff and volunteers and make sure that we are proactively addressing the situation. We hope that that's not the case because that will have a huge impact on our services.
Is this something that might ultimately involve National Guard deployment, given the arc of the infections and the potential for, indeed, for it to disrupt your service?
You know, that's something we have seen other food banks across the nation do, where they have requested National Guard to be out handing food out in those distributions. And I don't know if we are there in North Dakota yet or in Minnesota, but we have seen how that happens and how it works in different states. And it is something that is on our radar. And if we need to make that request, we will do so.
I suppose some people are concerned about possibility of transmission of the virus on the surface of a food package or something like that. What do you tell people about the safety of the food you distribute?
That's a great question, and that is something we get quite a bit. And according to, we're looking at the CDC, we're looking at Feeding America, which is really, they're leading this effort nationally and making sure that food banks have all of the correct facts and information. And they have shared with us that the virus is not transmitted through food or water. It is transmitted through close personal contact. And so as long as we are cleaning and sanitizing all of the surfaces that the food comes in contact with, all of the volunteers, if they have clean hands that are gloved, we confidently believe that we can get the food out quickly and safely. We have had questions because it has come up in the news that, can the virus live on cardboard boxes? And I think the latest we've heard is that it can live on the boxes up to 24 hours. And so anything that we're packing right now, whether it's in reusable bags, in plastic containers, in cardboard, it is sitting before it goes out to a family because we want to make sure that they're not getting that virus from any of the surfaces either.
I went online to your website, greatplainsfoodbank.org, and noted that one of the services you provide is Kids in Distress Situations, KIDS. You're a provider of all kinds of things besides food to kids.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, a really exciting project. If there are children's clothing or toys, that maybe there's a seasonal line change or leftover product after Christmas, we will get those types of items. We've gotten books and DVDs and shoes and clothing. And, we know that when a client is coming to get a food box, that's not the only thing they're struggling with. And so we do try to make sure that they can have those items as well as cleaning supplies and toilet paper and personal care items that often get overlooked.
And when kids are indoors for extended periods of time, it's useful to have a distraction for them.
Absolutely. Books and games, all of those things are wonderful ways to keep them entertained right now.
You mentioned the fundraising or food drives for the Great Plains Food Bank. Give our listeners a bigger picture of how that might work, how they might help.
Absolutely. And one of the great things that we have available on our website, so anyone who is quarantined or at home with their kids can still give back, even though you may not be able to get into our warehouse. We have a virtual food drive. So you can set up a food drive on our website. It shows all of the pictures of the different types of products. You can set a fundraising goal for yourself, and then you can email that out to all of your friends, your network, post it on social media, and it is a great way for people to get involved in, a meaningful way to get food into our warehouse so we can get it out. And I think the important thing, too, to talk about is that for every dollar that gets donated to the Great Plains Food Bank, we can get 3 meals out. So $1 goes a long way. And even if that's what you can donate is $1, $10, we can make a huge impact in a person's life.
That website again, greatplainsfoodbank.org. And Melissa Sobolek is president of the organization. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, the March Blizzard of 1920 is revisited by our Plains Folk essayist Tom Easern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at starianbank.com.
And by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home. Creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. 100 years ago was the Great March Blizzard of 1920, which claimed dozens of lives in North Dakota. Last week, Plains Folk essayist Tom Easern remembered one of the poignant stories of the tragedy. Today, he remembers other victims.
There is the Granite Monument. There is the song by Chuck Suki. and there are countless commemorations of the sacrificial death of Hazel Minor, the Oliver County farm girl who died saving her brother and sister from the killer blizzard of March 15th and 16th, 1920. There were others who died in that storm, however. Among them, according to the Fargo Forum the day after the storm, was a Mrs. Andrew Whitehead. Sorry, I haven't located a first name for her. Another press report says she was a college-trained Indian woman. The forum just called her an Indian whose body was found on a road between Devil's Lake and Fort Totten. Her 3-year-old son, whom she had wrapped in part of her own clothing, was still living, his feet and hands being frozen, but he will recover. Mrs. Whitehead was driving a team that became exhausted in the unequal battle against the elements. The most tragic episode associated with the spring blizzard of 1920 was that of the Walk brothers, 4 farm boys from Ryder, who perished attempting to make their way home from school. Their father, Gust Walk, was a German immigrant from Schleswig-Holstein. He was said to have been a former bodyguard to future Field Marshal von Hindenburg. Folk emigrated first to Minnesota and then on to North Dakota, settling near Ryder in 1902, among the earliest homesteaders in the locality. He was married to May Fredrickson, with whom he had 5 sons, Walter, Adolf, Ernst, Soren, and Hermann. Then in 1912, May died, giving birth to another boy, Lawrence, who also died at birth. There is an Albemann studio photograph of the widower, Gust, with all 5 of his sons, the 2 youngest boys, on his lap. Gust subsequently remarried. The centennial history of Ryder simply says, on March 16, 1920, Adolf, Ernst, Soren, and Hermann perished in a snowstorm on their way home from school. Older brother Walter was sick that day, and the 4 brothers were the only pupils who came to school. They turned around and started for home with a team and sled, but the horses played out about 3/4 of a mile from the house. Adolf bundled up his younger brothers and left them on the sled while he tried to make it home for help. He fell and froze to death about 1/4 mile short of safety. Father Gust went out looking for his boys and found poor Adolf first. Hours later, he found the sled covered with snow. The forum reported of the 3 younger boys. They had been buried by the snow, and their bodies were shoveled out by the father, into whose home the storm carried such a crushing blow. The 4 boys were buried in Rose Hill Cemetery. A marble spire placed for all of them reads simply, "Rest in Jesus." Small stone markers set in the ground give the names of the individual boys. Not to sound heartless, but I suppose if you started making monuments to everyone who died in snowstorms in North Dakota, there would be no end to it. Still, I think it is a good thing to speak their names. Perhaps someone from Spirit Lake will hear this and will see fit to inform us who the Mrs. Whitehead was who bundled up her baby against the cruel cold and finally lost the unequal battle against the elements.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, while we wait for the pandemic emergency to pass, the Heartland Marimba Quartet of Waterloo, Iowa, is planning concerts in Grand Forks and Minot. Prairie Public Music host Scott Prebus, a marimba player himself, visits with the founder of the quartet. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The South Central Human Service Center in Jamestown is reminding everyone that mental health is just as important as general health during the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Regional Director Dan Kramer says the center is seeing clients in a different way with a screening process to ensure their safety and health. He says services are also being prioritized.
So individuals that are not well, not safe, individuals that might be having thoughts of self-harm or harm to others, individuals that need hospitalization, we prioritize our services to those folks. So if you're not doing well right now, if you're struggling, if you're needing extra help or support, absolutely reach out to us.
Guidelines continue to be distancing yourself and isolating yourself from people. Kramer says this is the opposite of what they would normally tell someone with depression or other mental health disorders.
Those things are all true, and you need to follow those recommendations. But we also need to think about how do you do it in a way that still allows you to have connection. You know, so how do you find ways to still have connection, whether it's with immediate family, whether it's, you know, technology allows us to have connection in other ways with family that maybe don't live with us. How do we, if we don't have those folks, being aware of 211, being aware of those hotlines that are available for folks that I just need to talk to somebody. I'm going stir crazy in here.
South Central Human Services offers a 24/7 phone line for someone to talk to at 701-253-6304. Again, that's 701-253-6304. You can also call 211. Groups that support victims of domestic violence worry that more cases will arise as families hunker down during the pandemic. One North Dakota group says despite health guidelines to stay home, it's important to reach out if violence is an issue. The YWCA in Fargo is the largest emergency shelter for women and children in the state. CEO Aaron Prochnow says when a family with a volatile history is forced to be together in a stressful situation, there's a big risk of more problems occurring.
When you're confined in smaller spaces, I think there's no question that that power structure can continue on and escalate quickly.
Prochnow says her group had already seen a 13% increase in people being served since the start of the year. Prochnow says she's worried about how the pandemic will affect her organization's ability to help clients. She says it already has forced them to scale back certain fundraising efforts, and in-kind donations have also decreased.
Toothpaste and bread and toilet paper are things that aren't coming through our front doors right now. So we're needing to go out and purchase those things. While at the same time, if someone's paycheck's been cut, their ability to be helpful at this time is also lessened.
Despite challenges, Prochnow says the agency will do everything it can to assist women and children in need of services. And a Bismarck family has been posting on social media photos of hearts that were hung up in windows of houses, apartment buildings, hospitals, nursing homes, and businesses. It's dubbed hashtag A World of Hearts. The hearts are different sizes and colors. The family says it shows support during a time of social distancing. The state capital of North Dakota is getting into it as well. Governor Burgum says the lights in the state capitol tonight will be in the shape of a large heart.
We do that on New Year's, and we do that whenever the NDSU Bison win a national championship. But on the south side of the capitol, we will have a giant heart to participate in that. So keep those hearts flowing.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
On the next Morning Edition, toilet paper isn't the only thing that people are hoarding these days.
If you're holed up at home, having a pile of cash isn't going to do you a whole lot of good.
Also, hospitals in rural America turn to traveling doctors and nurses for help.
We've had full crews working nearly 24/7, 7 days a week.
Our continuing coverage of the coronavirus on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public. Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that is the sound of the marimba, a keyboard instrument with a magical woody tone that is played with mallets, sometimes two, sometimes four, and occasionally more than four mallets. The resonant sound is produced by rosewood, a hardwood that is placed over resonators to amplify the sound. The marimba, an instrument that I've had a love affair with for over four decades, and one that is being featured in Grand Forks and Minot in concerts by not one, but four highly talented marimbists. The Heartland Marimba Quartet, consisting of Matthew Coley, Ujjal Adhitarya, Michael Jones, and Joe Millay. They'll be presenting concerts in Grand Forks and Minot in September, and it is my pleasure to be talking with marimbist Matthew Coley. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for having me. And good. A great choice at the beginning there. Good to hear Nancy Zeltzman.
Oh, you know, you know your repertoire.
Yeah.
That's oh, great. Yeah. The marimba, a truly beautiful sound that is both engaging and, dare I say, mystical. What attracted you to the marimba?
Well, I think you said it there. The mysterious, mystical, alluring sound of the rosewood that comes from Central America, quite unlike any other musical instrument. And then for me, it was also the physicality of playing the instrument and watching the performer alongside of this amazing sound that was coming off of it was my draw back, I guess, now 30 years ago.
You know, it's an instrument that once you get through the acquiring the basic technique, it's really an instrument, as with many other musical instruments, that the performer becomes one with the instrument. And perhaps that's due to the mallets and the physicality of playing. But I always felt like playing a marimba was never work or hard practicing, you know, so to say. How do you feel about when you perform? What goes on in your head and the physical relationship between you and the marimba?
Yes. It's still sort of a therapeutic moment for me during the week if I just need, you know, in addition to the practice that I have to do and the music that I am scheduled to prepare, if I need a moment just to escape, I'll just go down and play the marimba and take some time to play some old tunes and really, like you're saying, just kind of engross myself in the physicality. But as far as performing, I think, there is quite a bit of preparation mentally that goes into performing on the instrument. We do a lot of our music memorized because we're not touching the instrument physically. We're using mallets to create the sound along with our motions. And coming at the same maybe chord on the instrument can be different in every piece. So if you play a C major chord in one piece, it's going to feel very different to the other piece. So I'm always calculating and noticing these small changes and shifts, but also really much enjoying that physical just labyrinth that you go through when playing the instrument.
And, you know, we've used the term mallets for our listeners that may not be familiar with the marimba. Uh-huh. Some people call them hammers, but they consist of rubber and various types of yarn. How much care goes into selecting the right kind of yarn mallets or rubber mallets for the music, because you've got plenty of choices?
Oh, yes. So, if we're thinking about the marimba quartet, we're coming on stage or we're performing usually with four mallets each, so 16 different mallets within a piece of music. And then we each own thousands of mallets. And that is a big portion of our rehearsal together is choosing that sound within each player, which mallet works best for the tenor voice, which mallet works best for the alto player in the ensemble. And it's all very different. I typically play the highest voice, so I'm using the harder mallets. And do I want it to be a hard and bright sound? Do I want to blend a little more? Do I need to roll a lot, tremolo a lot? So there's quite a bit of care going into this, and we're always hoarding as many mallets as we can, from rubber to yarn to cord wound.
I remember in the days when Lee Howard Stevens was coming up as a musician, and the first time I saw him, Lee would walk on stage with literally 60 mallets in his bag, just a huge bag. And I remember being so impressed with that. But the yarn mallets were all white. And I remember wondering how he made those quick mallet changes. because I use different colors of mallets to depict my sound. If you just tuned in, I am talking with Matthew Coley, a marimbist who's a member of the Heartland Marimba Quartet. They will be touring North Dakota and the Upper Midwest in September. This date was changed, as all musical dates were changed around the country due to the coronavirus situation, but looking forward to that. They will be performing with the Minot Symphony Orchestra and on the campus of the University of North Dakota. Now, a marimba is not a small instrument. The Heartland Marimba Quartet, I would assume, tours with four marimbas. Would that be correct?
We do.
Yeah.
We have a trailer.
That's a lot of packing up and unpacking, and that's a lot of weight.
Yes, so we recently acquired two more instruments. We used to travel, I had two 5-octave instruments, which is each one is about 8 feet long. And then we would either arrange other ones or borrow ones, or another player would drive one to the kind of central place where we were touring or rehearsing. But now the organization has four instruments, and we have a trailer, and we have 36 or so different cases to pack them in.
With a percussionist, it's always going to be, it's never easy, is it? Like a flautist.
Oh, no, it's a lifestyle.
If it's not a marimba, it's timpani, it's a drum set or something. It's always six trips to the car, as I say. In the early days, marimba ensembles and marimba players had to rely on transcriptions of music. But that has changed as more composers realize the potential of the instrument as a solo instrument. How do the Heartland Marimba Quartet approach the selection of music?
So when I started the group in 2016, I looked at the repertoire and I thought a lot about this because, you know, even from my days in school, I was in undergrad in the late 90s and early 2000s for graduate work. My teachers were encouraging me to compose, and all of my teachers were composers, Michael Burritt, Mark Ford, Christopher Dean. And so I did a lot of writing myself and a lot of arranging. And when I started the ensemble, I looked at the music that was really influential for me. I wanted to do a mix of some transcriptions, so I set out to find those unique ones, since there are kind of those stock transcriptions the percussion world uses. I wanted to find some newer ones, and then we chose music that would either be familiar within the percussion world or captivating to a general audience. But there's a fair amount to choose from compared to the string quartet. There's very little music. We're in the infant stage of marimba quartet. But for percussion world, there's been a surge in the last 20 years, and it was great to kind of start exploring as much of that as we could. So we mixed it up. We did some music by Michael Burritt. We got some pieces commissioned for us. So we really think a lot about repertoire, and now we're actually on the path to commissioning as many female composers as we can, because that was one area where we found there actually really wasn't any marimba quartet music by women composers, unfortunately. So we are on a mission to get that changed.
Now, over the years, as I have watched audiences watch marimbists, I've always found audiences to be deeply engaged, whether they're familiar with the instrument or not, because the performers are very animated. You know, you can't say the same thing about a brass quintet or a string quartet who have a limited sense of motion in contrast. But a marimba is 6-7 feet long, so each of the players is walking to the left or the right, and there's a lot of manipulation of the arms and the body. Audiences seem to love watching players maneuver around the instrument, showcasing dexterous technique. Have you noticed that in your audiences?
Yes, we, you know, that is a core component of, you know, marketing our group. We not only want to go into these communities, and we travel to communities of all sizes, really, really small towns in the Midwest, farm towns, to, you know, big city concerts. And some of our favorite performances are these smaller communities where people just, you know, they just rush the stage and say, oh, it was so great to listen to, and it was wonderful to watch you guys moving. And, you know, that's really fortunate for us, because I was telling another interviewer for our February tour for the Chicago Tribune paper that, you know, we're always trying to prove ourselves for people to keep us around in the classical music world. And so every concert is kind of an audition, and because it's such a young ensemble compared to other instruments. So fortunately, the movement part of it works on our side, and we think a lot about that, and we discuss, you know, some ways that we can communicate more through the movement.
On a typical concert, following a typical concert, how many people come backstage and want to see and touch and look at the instrument?
Oh, yeah. we usually will invite, so, you know, we just did a tour in the Midwest in February. We did a concert, two concerts in Des Moines with a dance company there, two dance companies, actually, Hurley and Dancers and Dance Arts in Des Moines. And then we went from Des Moines to Rochester in Minnesota to play at a church on a series. And we always invite the audiences, especially in smaller venues like that, where it's 200 audience members or so, and it's a small community, small venue. You know, we usually do a Q&A, and then we'll just invite people. And we'll get, 30, 35 people up there, and they'll just have wonderful questions, and they'll want to see things up close and maybe watch us play up close. And sometimes we'll let children do a little hands-on, try it out for themselves.
It's an absolutely beautiful instrument, isn't it? With the rosewood bars, the sheen of the wood, and the resonators all in a long frame. It's a stunningly beautiful instrument.
It is. And, you know, the aesthetics and the design of it have in the present day with these instruments has really gone to some special level. And you can just kind of look and behold this proportioned, it's really well proportioned instrument with the resonators and the bars and the trapezoidal shape. Really kind of stretched out trapezoid.
Now, the Heartland Marimba Quartet will be touring Minnesota, North Dakota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. It is a very animated instrument to perform on, and, of course, it takes a long time to set up and tear down. How do you set up your tour schedule? Do you plan a performance every 2 days or so? Is it possible for you to pack in every day with traveling? How do you approach that?
Yes. You know, I think a lot about this all the time because I'm doing most of the booking for the group. And, you know, so it's a little bit, a portion of it is skill and strategy. And a portion of it is some kind of sorcery and luck. And it just kind of sometimes falls into place. But usually we start with sort of a larger gig, what we'll call an anchor gig, or two, where, you know, an organization such as the Minot Symphony will hire us to do a premiere, and then they happen to be affiliated with the Minot State University. So the teacher, the percussion teacher there, wanted us around for a day of percussion since we're already in the area. So we created a pretty large residency in the city of Minot. And then from there, like this tour that I planned in April and May, we were heading back down to Dubuque, Iowa, to do another concerto with the Dubuque Symphony. And that's where I was talking about the sorcery came into play, and the universe was smiling on us. Those two fell together in the same area of the calendar, and so we could make a tour out of it. And then we fill in the in-between points where, you know, okay, we're driving from Madison, Wisconsin to Minot. That takes about 9 hours. We should allow 2 days, and maybe on the first day we'll stop halfway, and then that's how we booked the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. So that was kind of an in-between gig. So we'll fill in those days with traveling or a day off or sightseeing or another gig, maybe at a high school or another concert series, whatever we can convince people to hire us for.
Well, there's no shortage of appreciation for those towns that have universities with good percussion programs, that have percussion majors, that volunteer to help you move your stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's always appreciative to have somebody else carry those cases out. Matthew Coley of the Heartland Marimba Quartet. If you have never seen a marimba performance or a marimba quartet performance, let me strongly urge you to enjoy the Heartland Marimba Quartet. It is magical music, and it is very interesting to watch the, if I may say, choreography of the marimba players as they play through their repertoire. Matthew, great talking with you, and good luck on the tour. I really can't wait to hear you guys.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. And just wanted to say we have a new album out there. It's called Vision by the Heartland Marimba Quartet. If you're interested in hearing a collection of our repertoire from the last couple seasons. But yeah, it's been really nice talking to you, and we look forward to our visit to North Dakota in September.
And send me a copy of the CD. I'll be glad to program it.
I will. I'd love to. I'll get that right out.
Matthew Coley, the Heartland Marimba Quartet. This was Scott Prebis for Main Street.
Stuck at home? Well, there's always the radio. Still have one, right? Well, dust it off and turn it on. No matter where you are in North Dakota, Northwest Minnesota, or Eastern Montana, there's always a Prairie Public Radio signal to tune in. Or you can open a smartphone app, listen to one of our web streams at prairiepublic.org, or even better, you can enable a smart speaker and tell it to play NPR or Prairie Public. We've got all the news programming and vital information you need to stay on top of what's keeping many of us inside, plus a bevy of excellent programs to help you keep your mind off of it for a little bit. And on that note, we have two of the best music hosts in the business. Scott Prebis plays the beautiful classical music, and Mike Olson takes you on a sonic roots, rock, and jazz adventure every weekday. We will all get through this together, even if we can't be around each other so much. So, we invite you to listen to Prairie Public, your stay-at-home radio station. Today's programming is made possible in part by the Benedictine Sisters of Annunciation Monastery, Bismarck, providing a prayerful presence and serving others for over 140 years.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 25th. Celebrating the 100th year since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
By this date in 1920, 35 of the 36 states needed had ratified the 19th Amendment. Some states had already granted full or partial suffrage. North Dakota was one of 12 that had granted partial suffrage, and as a result, women were able to participate in their first presidential primary. A court ruling found that women could also run for election as delegate to national party conventions, and two women were on the ballot for those positions. Yet some questions remained about the logistics of women voting. Assistant Attorney General F. E. Packard noted that it wasn't clear how to establish party registration for women, though he thought that if the 19th Amendment was ratified by enough states prior to the primary, all laws connected to the qualifications, registration, and voting of men electors would apply without additional legislation. But that didn't happen in time for the primary. And there was even concern that the amendment might not be ratified in time for the general election, or at all. West Virginia had barely approved ratification on March 10th, becoming the 34th state. Washington became the 35th on March 22nd. But Delaware's bid to become the deciding 36th state failed on June 2nd. Moreover, a report out of Washington cautioned that even if the 19th Amendment was fully ratified before November, some women could still be unable to vote unless changes were made in some registration laws. Registration closed in Georgia by the 1st of May, and they closed in Rhode Island by the end of June. Other states required paid-up taxes, and some had a poll tax to consider. Such rules and regulations would need to be examined. In North Dakota, the women voted in the primary under the policies explained in this quote from the Bismarck Tribune. Women who were registered in the election of 1918 or who were registered by reason of participation in the primary election of 1918 are on the poll lists and are fully qualified to vote. The woman whose husband is a constant voter and whose husband is registered will not be required to swear in her vote. Women not registered and not falling in the second list will be obliged to swear in their vote, accomplished on the affidavit of two property owners of the precinct in which she resides. I'm Sarah Walker.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
COVID-19 has changed daily life in the U.S. We'll be answering your questions live every weekday on The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.
The National Conversation. Listen weeknights at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
When the world is uncertain, who can you trust? When it's important to hear from somebody local who has the access. There's no time like now to listen to your trusted source for fact-based independent journalism. Listener-supported Prairie Public is North Dakota's home for NPR News and essential regional coverage. Listen like it matters on your radio, online, or on your smart speaker. We are Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, the COVID-19 pandemic has resulted in many people working from home. For some, the transition is pretty easy, but that can depend on what you know about your digital options. It's called digital literacy, and on our show tomorrow, we'll learn about Microsoft TechSpark, which pairs tech professionals with teachers and others. And if you have a little extra time at home, you could try making long fermentation breads like sourdough. Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.